Okay, it seems the audio is fine. So I guess, well, look, we're already recording, so we can just kind of go ahead. Yep.
John is going to do a little bit of an introduction to the show and then to you guys.
Awesome.
And he has a little script or a little formula to follow. I basically play the foil to all this, to everybody who knows shit. I know nothing because it's true. I know nothing. You guys will be the smart guys and I'll be the dumb guy.
I think you should edit this in. I think it gives it pizzazz. I think it should have started already.
Beginning of the show. A cold open. A cold open, exactly. Yeah.
I'm Alex Searle. I live in Valencia in Spain, and I'm from Cape Town. And I have a business that does video production for other businesses and organizations, and I also work as a content strategist.
My name is Edward Fisher, based in London in the United Kingdom, and I'm a commercial director of a software company and also an entrepreneur. My background is specifically in B2B commercial growth.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 13 of the Resource Cast. Today, we are talking about sourcing work from overseas, be it through LinkedIn and any other platform. We are talking about getting yourself some of that sweet dollar euro action, considering that the South African economy has just taken a big old smack in the face. We are joined once again by Lucas van Vieren, my standard sidekick, also known as Jon Snow.
Jon Snow?
Because you know nothing.
When did that happen? Okay, cool. I know nothing. For a second, I was still like, devastatingly handsome?
And then we're also joined today by Alex Searle from Valencia, Spain, although he's a South African. Hi, Alex.
Hola.
And Edward Fisher, who is also a South African living in the UK. Hi, Ed.
Okay.
Hi, Edward.
Hello, Bru. I had a bit of a timeout issue there. Sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. I think... Up front, I think we're probably going to have a few little timeout issues in terms of the audio, but we'll struggle through. But this is the first time also that we're having a conversation with four people at once. So it probably might get a little bit messy. What Lucas and I will try to do is give you guys the space to share your knowledge, and then we'll kick in at the end of whenever you take a breath, we'll jump in, you know. So, as I said in the intro, we're talking today about how to find some work. If you're living in South Africa, especially during the whole COVID thing, how can you source work from overseas? So I know that you guys have been, as you said, Edward, you've been working on B2B growth for quite a long time. Alex is now actively using LinkedIn and other platforms to create content. So he's both working on a kind of, I would say, would you say it's accurate to say you directly find clients overseas through online tools, and also that you are creating content for kind of a more organic growth on your LinkedIn profile. You create a lot of content, which I think leads to business, but not in a direct sourcing way.
Definitely. So it's a weird kind of organic, slightly unpredictable process, but at the same time, you kind of have to do both of those things together in order to push it forward. So there's definitely the content creation, which are these vlogs that I try and put out once a month on, you know, a topic that interests me or something that I want to talk about. And then there's using LinkedIn as well as a tool, mainly as a sort of, not so much as a tool to get business, but rather as an intelligence mechanism of some kind. So if I'm able to learn from it or, you know, find other people to start talking to, then LinkedIn is really useful for that.
Yeah. Right. And you guys, you and Edward have actually worked together for a number of years as well.
Too long.
Indeed. Yeah, there's a lot of trauma there. We have indeed. So, in fact, I started working with Alex in about 2013. I worked for a UK company that specialized in business development, specifically B2B. And Alex was actually my first hire. I was the first hire in Cape Town for the company, and he followed next. And sort of 2 or 3 years later, I think we were probably a team of about 20. So it was an interesting road. And then we also founded a company together thereafter. So we've certainly sort of spent a fair amount of time sort of getting to know one another, much to Alex's detriment. So,
you guys have now, as you know, you founded a company together. You're still working together, even though Edward, you're in the UK and Alex, you're in Spain now. So, how the fact that you both immigrated, like, what was the journey that kind of led you to that? Let's start with Edward. I mean, you obviously, if you were at the head of this company with, like, you know, 20 people or so, how did that translate into you then going to London?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think what happened was that, you know, my work sort of, you know, initially before starting my own company was quite instrumental in helping me to realize that it is possible to grow in other geographies. Most of our clients were based in the UK, while our sales team was based in South Africa. And it was quite a high value offering. I was always under the impression that, you know, if somebody was going to be parting with lots of cash, they wanted to see the whites of your eyes. Yeah. But, you know, one of the things that, you know, sort of dissuaded us otherwise is the fact that we were quite involved for some time with something called social selling, which is essentially a fancy term for building credibility from a distance. And, you know, once I realized that, you know, it made it sort of more feasible to look at, you know, sort of starting up my own venture, I suppose. And, you know, it just tested and proved the fact that it was possible. And we can obviously kind of get into a bit of what that methodology sort of centers around in a little bit. And then having started my own company, we grew quite rapidly in the UK. I had some really great partners. And I just realized that, you know, eventually in terms of servicing clients and growing them, that it would make sense to sort of move over here. And then sort of subsequently sold that company about a year and a half ago. So that's kind of the journey from my perspective. But I'm sure Alex's story is probably a bit more colorful and interesting. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, it was I suppose some of the reasons for kind of coming over were similar as well, you know, wanting to kind of grow things and just jump into a different pond, a bit of a bigger pond, and, you know, find other challenges, but also with the kind of the support from South Africa as well. So never kind of completely letting go of that line. For me, my mom is Spanish, although not culturally, but that's kind of how I was able to, you know, come to Spain. I thought about the UK, but then I thought about, you know, the kind of the grey weather and so on. And Ed certainly has a much stronger stomach for that, you know, kind of weather than I do. So rather take my chances in Spain. Yeah, I mean, there have been actually some difficulties around sort of like, you know, settling here and my passport and all of that. We'll keep that for another podcast. That there's sure. Quite a story to tell there. But anyway, aside from that, it's definitely been a really big leap forward because I've met lots of more people. You know, I've also been able to still sustain the business in South Africa in a way that has kind of surprised me. It's been longer than I thought it would be, you know, which is great. You know, I didn't come with the idea of sort of coming in and letting it go. But, you know, I had the idea, well, you know, let's see how long I can kind of hold on to things being, you know, remotely managed in South Africa.
Sure.
Or at least me remotely managing it from here in South Africa. And that's continued to be a model that's kind of sustained itself, which is lucky, but it's also been off the back of a lot of hard work too. And the fact that I work with a great partner in South Africa too. So, yeah, a very interesting story.
How are you finding the language? Because Spanish is supposed to be one of the easier languages to learn if you speak English, but I personally found it quite a struggle.
It's, you know, I always feel bad when people ask me that question because I haven't had like a Spanish job or a massive group of Spanish friends where I'm like actively practicing it and listening to it every day and getting the chance to really develop it. And so, if anything, like I practiced more Spanish before I left because I was actively taking lessons from this really cool guy that I met in Cape Town from Alicante. And he was really cool. He took me for beers, learned lots of adjectives, was awesome. But the point is that after that, and after I kind of came here and sort of just got stuck in and, you know, also making a lot of friends that were mainly expats and you just speaking English, you don't really get that much exposure to it, which has been unfortunate. So I've got to just sort of, you know, pull my socks up and get back into Duolingo.
Yeah.
But to answer your question, Spanish, it hasn't really been a stumbling block for me because I haven't relied on, for example, a Spanish client or a Spanish business in order to put food on the table. So, Right. Yeah, which is good in a way because it means that, you know, you can do it here. You can theoretically really do it anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, on that, Lucas's main client right now is in Australia. So he's obviously dealing with quite a big time zone lag. But overall, would you guys in general say, I mean, and you've also been doing this remote working thing for years now, but would you say that the technology is now there? Like, I think most people agree that between Zoom and Google Suite and all that kind of thing, remote working is a hell of a lot easier than it used to be and is now workable.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I would say that, you know, sort of there's still some things that are of a major benefit to meeting face to face. Particularly if you don't have sort of like a video feed, being able to read people's body language and understand how engaged they are and so on. Mm. But certainly from a comms and project management perspective, I don't think it's any sort of, it's no longer necessary to meet people. I mean, when Alex and I worked together, we were working with people in Australia, the East Coast of the United States, West Coast of the States, Dubai, the UK. You could imagine that our sleep patterns were somewhat erratic. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that was 5-6 years ago. And I think things have only improved since then.
Yeah. A little bit random, but I came across one particularly sneaky little tip that I'm not sure if I learned it from you guys or someone else. But the idea was that if you're on a Zoom call and you're having a meeting, is that you open up a Google Doc and then someone writes the notes of the meeting, like the minutes. But then everyone is watching that document, which means that you can alter it as it goes and people can say, that's not really what I meant. And agree on the minutes during the meeting kind of thing. So I thought that was quite a nice rule. I've been kind of using that in meetings. Because
like a community scribe.
Yeah, and then there's just no, because even with someone taking minutes, there's inevitably like broken telephone. But it used to work quite well.
Or if punctuation is not important to you, voice to text on Google Docs can also be quite helpful.
Yeah. Right, so I just want to dig down a little bit now into how you guys approach sourcing work now. And then I guess I would ask you to tilt it towards if you're a South African creative, because that's kind of who our audience is. Like what's your experience been in the past? What do you do right now? And how would you kind of adapt any strategies you use for a South African designer, artist, writer, whatever it might be?
You go first, Dan.
Alex, do you want to kick off? Oh, so much politeness.
Let's go reverse alphabetic. Oh, well, actually, let's have Alex since just give us an answer.
Okay, so what part do you want sort of answered first? Is it more about just using sort of LinkedIn, or has it been the experience of finding work? Or
what? Well, I want to be careful about not making LinkedIn the be-all and end-all of it, because I think Edward asked me to remember that LinkedIn is a tool and it's part of the whole network. It's not the thing, although it might be the main kind of tool used.
No, sure.
Yeah. So, I guess it would be, but let's start there because everyone's on it. So they've at least got that as a frame of reference.
Okay. So my experience of using LinkedIn as a way to win work or to find new clients. Okay. Yes. So I mean, I've focused on LinkedIn almost exclusively. I mean, there's some stuff on sort of YouTube and here and there, but like I'd say 90% of what I've tried to do to win work, to build a bit of a personal brand for myself, to bring an interest around my business is done on LinkedIn. So there are a few reasons for that. Firstly, because a lot of my audience is on LinkedIn, you know, B2B, certain sort of niche sectors such as renewable energy, finance, software, and so on. So it's easier to kind of get through to a business audience on LinkedIn as opposed to, you know, Facebook or anything like that. The second reason is because I'm a content creator, LinkedIn loves native content or original content. So for example, with my vlog, when I produce a video each month and I upload it, I get a really good organic reach and I don't pay for it. I don't have a LinkedIn premium account because I'm a bit of a cheapo, but without needing to kind of put any paid spend behind my content, I can easily reach over a couple thousand views every time, which is pretty good for LinkedIn. You know, I'm not necessarily interested in going crazy viral or anything like that, but if I'm speaking to a kind of a specific audience, then that's pretty good going for something that is organically reached. And so LinkedIn's great for that. There's also a really kind of, I'd say thirdly, another good reason for it is because there's a sort of a community there, which I think is quite supportive of you know, if you're putting something out there and you're asking a question or you're wanting comment or feedback about something, then chances are you'll get a bit more engagement than some other social media platforms. And so I found that that's quite useful when it comes to, you know, getting people to engage on a topic or, you know, please share and like the video. And, you know, if it's going to help somebody else, please tag them. And I found that that works rather than maybe it might be a bit more cursory on other social media platforms. So it's good for that, I'd say.
I think I was listening to Gary Vaynerchuk. How do you pronounce Gary V's?
Vaynerchuk.
Vaynerchuk.
Or more
Gary V.
That there was also an observation that it's still of all the social platforms, the only one that you can actually get organic.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it allows itself still to do that. Whereas the algorithms, like on all the other social platforms, just cut it down. They go, no, if you're not paid promotions, you don't get it.
And unfortunately, on that, like I've started to see, compared with when I started my vlog last year, compared with now, that the organic reach has slowly been deteriorating, unfortunately, because I think LinkedIn are trying to kind of, just like Facebook did, there was a time when organic reach on Facebook was excellent, but now they're trying to sort of, you know, keep that for paid or premium services or when you put spend behind it, unfortunately. So, yeah.
But it's a weird one. If from a logic point of view, it's a self-promotional tool. So it's a place where your work sits there. And I understand from a brand point of view, because that all the other social channels kind of stopped themselves because brands got involved. And that's actually linked to sales and self-promotion as well, to a brand promotion. So that leads to money. So that makes sense. But it's not another friend wanting to send another friend request to someone else. There's no charge for that. Well, so we're in LinkedIn. This is now literally, it was created for professionals to connect. So it's such a strange space now to deteriorate that organic reach.
It's hard to know, and I'm sure, Ed, you've got a lot of ideas on this as well, but like, it's hard to know the sort of the correct etiquette on LinkedIn on how much to promote, how much to sort of put yourself out there. At the same time, though, I think what a lot of creatives get wrong on LinkedIn specifically is that they just see it as something where they can kind of just put this, you know, an upgraded version of their CV onto a profile and then just sort of expect work to come in, especially, you know, editors, digital, you know, graphic designers and so on. I've seen that, you know, where they're kind of just like, here's my portfolio, give me a ring if you need, you know, your next PDF designed or something like that. But it doesn't work like that. You know, this is why LinkedIn kind of encourages a bit more of a conversation. You've got to be stirring up your own pot a little bit in order for that interest to come your way.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, the kind of fire and forget posts I've noticed don't really tend to work.
No.
But on the other side of it, there's also, you can't shake the sense that it's a bunch of people looking for work all talking to each other animated while people who actually employ people are just not there. So it's, I guess if we separate kind of LinkedIn prospecting into very direct methods and then into the organic method, have you, Alex, personally had experience of gaining work through organic content? Someone saying, I love what you're doing and I'd like to work with you?
Yes. Luckily, yes. It's not always something that you can measure directly or kind of know it's going to happen this time around, but almost always there's a comment or a conversation gets started or something that kind of progresses to something tangible. And of course, that also means that I've got to be the one to quickly follow up and to quickly kind of be on it and, you know, okay, let's have a call. Let's do something with it. Because you can easily kind of just go, yeah, thanks for the comment and sort of let it go.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So following up on people who do actually take the time to comment, you know, that might be to try and continue the conversation a little bit or.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's an important thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the comment, reply back, try and DM them, definitely send them a connection request. Yeah.
Right. Can I ask if you, in a percentage, in the world of percentages, so your actual work and self-promotion, what's your day broken up into? So if as an example, I can't imagine from an admin point of view, even like because of working on brands, you usually have a social media manager, someone who literally sits there and monitors and interacts and stuff like that. So if it reaches a certain scale, it's not you doing it because you, and how much of that time suck happens on LinkedIn? Does that question make sense?
For me?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a weird one because I've got stuff that I do for my business, and then I've got almost more personal stuff that I do as well. And all the personal stuff has to come from me. I've got to find time to record the vlog. I've got to put a post together on LinkedIn. I've got to manage comments that come in and all that. And that's okay because it's still at a sort of a relatively low. I'm not managing massive brand campaigns or anything. But on the other side of it, when you do need to sort of put a bit of a system together so that you can, like Jonna was saying, you know, have a bit more of a regular direct kind of mechanism of generating leads or interest, then you do need help. You know, you do need to, that might be something that I put like maybe an hour a day into, maybe three or 4 hours a week into on average. I mean, it changes, but yeah.
So, cool. So let's stick with, sorry, Edward, I know you're not getting a lot of time.
No.
It's cool. I'm going to come to you for the second half of it, but let's stick there on this organic strategy here, which is content creation. Essentially, it's the brand advertising of your own, you know, offering. So what, I mean, for those of our listeners who don't, you know you, what kind of stuff do? You mentioned the vlog, right?
Yes. So the vlog is something I try and do monthly every sort of 4 or 5 weeks. And it's a short sort of maybe 2-3.5 minute video of, you know, original content. I shoot it. I sort of script it and edit it all together myself. And it's normally about things that are either interesting me or certain things that I'm doing. Sometimes I find that, in daily life, you know, for example, the last one was about the lockdown and how businesses are, and, you know, organizations, including, you know, people like myself, small businesses have a unique opportunity now to be using this time to ultimately sort of transform what they're doing and use it as a way to try and almost revitalize how they make money, right? How they grow their businesses and so on. And I kind of offer a couple ideas on how they do that. So normally it's sort of, I try and make it topical, but usually it's about something that I think will help other people. And that's the key as well. It can't just be as my mother-in-law sometimes says, you can't be an eye specialist. It can't just be me. And it's true. You know? I know it's super lame, but it's true. It has to kind of be about how this might apply to you. Does it involve you? Here's why you should, you know, give a shit about it. Mm. And here's what you could do if you're in that situation yourself.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of tips, I suppose you can call it that, you know, in a sort of broad sense, but it has to offer value in some way. Why must I spend 2 minutes watching a video? You know, that's a huge ask for somebody.
Yeah, absolutely.
Scrolling. Yeah.
I think it certainly taps into a key pain point that I have with going to any Pitjor-Kutcher, TEDx, Design Indaba, is when someone speaks about themselves, like, here's my portfolio, but then doesn't link what they've learned or what they can do into useful information for the people who are listening to it, right? So absolutely don't talk about yourself. I think it's, you know, either you're giving some form of thought leadership or you're giving some kind of belief that other people can align themselves to. Like, you can say, I believe this. And if someone, prospective client or someone who might work with you, thinks the same thing, then you've created a kind of a connection between the two of you. So that's
exactly
the content. That's kind of like, and you're creating these vlogs, which, by the way, like, are very awesome and very well produced. And I think as you obviously plan, you know, they demonstrate your video creation abilities, editing, voiceover, writing, everything as well. So there's that parallel, that alignment. So what kind of results, you say you have been getting some work out of that kind of thing, but do you set yourself any kind of rules? You say 3 to 4 hours of work on that kind of stuff a week, and your goals are obviously to establish yourself as something of a thought leader, to show off your skills in editing and filming because you're shooting in Spain and there's some amazing shots there. Any other kind of purposes to this organic content?
A few. I mean, there's a few different types of goals. I mean, I don't necessarily approach it with the idea of like, okay, with this video, I'm going to get 5 leads. You know, it's more about making sure that I'm consistently doing and saying something and remaining relevant in a way that I think is worthwhile. But also, the consistency part I've noticed is super important because a few months ago, last year, I kind of, you know, let it drop a bit and I didn't post as much. And I realized, I sort of saw very plainly that there was a drop in, you know, views to my profile. There was a drop in, you know, kind of business coming in and so on. So even though it's not directly measurable, it is a huge part of what, you know, of what goes on and how I cement that brand, if you like, and how that ultimately yields in new clients coming in. And also it's about sort of throwing the line further out into the future. You can't expect, you know, someone to knock on your door in a week's time and say, hey, here's a project, boom. But it's about somebody kind of maybe commenting every, you know, every time you post, and then you kind of end up developing a relationship or nurturing something with them over time. And then that turns into a piece of business or a client or maybe someone who introduces you to someone else. So once again, it's difficult to measure, but the fact that you're doing it, I think is, or that you get to do it, or that you find a way to do it, develop a style and a voice is super important, because it kind of cements all of those things at the same time, which is essential if you work for yourself. You have to be doing that. You have to be self-sustainable.
Like that. Yeah. And I guess you have to come to terms with the fact that it's time you're putting in for the future. It's an investment that doesn't pay off immediately. And that can be tough in the world of content creation when it takes time and effort and all that kind of thing. I mean, when you stepped away for a second, was that because you had experienced some form of content creation burnout, or were you just busy? Or?
Part of it. Another part of it is because I had a second kid. So that's sort of, you know, that was a big time sucker. Mm-hmm. So there are definitely a few, if, you know, life happens, you know, and that's fine. And you know, we're not all Casey Neistat where we can, you know, we can be posting vlogs riding around New York City on our skateboard every day. So that's okay as well. You know, I think there's also this pressure you feel that everyone's watching now. You know, I've published one video, I've sent out one article. The world according to me, what's going to be the next page? So that's also a bit of a thing that can happen to you, which is obviously an illusion. But once again, the key is just as long as you're still remaining part of some sort of conversation and trying to remain consistent, I think that's the most important thing that you can do. And whatever that consistency is, maybe it's once every 3 months. It doesn't have to be once a day, once a month, whatever it is. I think that's what you can stick to. You know, I'm talking too much.
Well, I'm going to pass after you, Lucas. Go ahead.
It's an interesting thing that you said about how much content. So my feeling on most social media, most platforms, is that it's so throwaway. Even if an article comes through that you like, it's so throwaway.
I feel that way too.
I think the more time you spend on it, I think the system of however you do it, if it is the work that you've been doing or it is something that's interesting, it needs to be sustainable. Even if you think about the podcast, this is interesting to me to hear people's approaches and different things. So this to me is completely sustainable. I don't know how sustainable it is for John, but it is, it's just part of your daily routine or something that you already like. So it's at least natural. Where, like you mentioned, Casey Neistat, he puts so much energy and so much effort into it, especially in the beginning year with very little response. But that's also all right. But the idea is not to spend too much of your own money on it and not to exert too much of your own energy on it, that it's still something that's in your interest. So,
and doable.
And I think that's kind of the trick sometimes. But I take my hat off to anybody who has to now start editing something, then animating it, and then illustrating it, and then, you know, like once the production value gets up and up and up, then the reward needs to be so much bigger on the other side of this, if that makes sense. Because if you look at Casey as an example, it's just up and up and up and up and up because the reward became so much bigger.
It's interesting. Sorry, the very last thing on this is that I found, weirdly enough, that compared with when I started doing this, I found that the amount of time or the kind of the stress that I put into the production has actually gotten less, not only because I've now honed a little bit of a process for myself on what it looks like to create one of these, but I kind of went out and did a lot more sort of shooting of all these different things. And I think I put more kind of like sort of like qualitative time into it because I thought, wow, each one of these is going to be like a really cool film on its own. But now they've kind of just been sort of straight kind of raw, unfiltered opinion pieces. That's sort of where it's gone. And so I found that you're able to kind of make it more economical as you go rather than it being a bigger monster. Obviously, there are different ways to do it, but that's what I found.
That's a good point.
And that's kind of, you know, where kind of Lucas and I have chatted about this podcast as well, is that the balance of careful content creation and kind of off-the-cuff, real, authentic where you just kind of spit it out kind of thing. And it's what's weird is that you kind of need practice to get that kind of off the cuff feel. It doesn't just, it's because it just sounds like a mess if you're not doing it carefully, you know? So with experience, obviously you get better and faster.
Definitely.
I think, have we got Edward back? I think he just popped out there for a sec. Great.
Yeah, sorry.
I think phone in again. I think we should phone in again. I see you've got 2 minutes left on this.
Oh, yes, of course. Okay, so we're just going to, if you guys don't mind, can we just put down quick and I'll send you a new link because I don't have the premium version.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Back in sick.
We're a professional organization.
Yeah. Okay, so we're back. This is the second half of the interview about finding work overseas. And we are back about 3 days later because we had a few technical difficulties, which means I didn't click record on the second half of the interview on Monday. So we got Alex and Edward and Lucas very, very kindly returned for the second half. And in the first half of this interview, we were talking about the more organic way to drive business and relationships using LinkedIn. And that's, you know, Alex's strategy of creating content. It's not really a strategy, it's something he likes to do, creating content and thought leadership pieces and filming himself and making vlogs. And then right now we're switching over to the more direct method of kind of direct marketing and growth with Edward, who's got a whole system and philosophy that I'm going to ask him to repeat again. Hi, first of all, hello, Lucas. Hello, Edward. Hello, Alex. How's it going, guys?
Just for everybody listening, we've already made fun of John for making this misstep. I figure it's the way he's been brought up. I just think it's a reflection on his mother, really.
And then, I think
my mom's the only person toxic in the family listens to this. Mommy didn't mean it.
I think any toxic shame we can instill in John at this, like, sort of, you know, juncture is going to be really valuable moving forward. So,
there are a few things in life that give me as much pleasure as bullying John.
It's a thin layer of shame over many, many sedimentary years of horror. So don't worry about it.
Can I just say this is a much stronger opening than the one that Alex did last time? I think this should be the beginning of the podcast. Seeing you're assassinating everyone. Yeah.
I'm recording it.
Let's say something horrible about Alex. Your shirt's brown. Okay. I don't like it.
You're not actually recording it though, John.
He is. Luckily, I double checked that one. It probably gave him like a...
On my side, nothing happening. Oh, well. Okay, maybe you are. Time will tell. Let me just start off by saying how enthused I am to be covering this subject matter again. And that's mainly because I love the sound of my own voice. So, you know, if you don't hit record in this attempt, if that's perfectly cool too, we can do this again.
We'll come back. It's all good. No worries.
Brilliant. Okay. So let's pick up where Alex left off. Alex was busy talking about LinkedIn. And, you know, he was talking about the fact that, like, organic reach is one of the benefits for him. For our particular company, we don't do sort of, you know, any organic marketing on LinkedIn. And we certainly don't use it as a direct channel for engaging with people. That's not to say it's not useful for those things. But, you know, we found that LinkedIn offers sort of, you know, a really, really good way of being able to identify and earmark the people we want to go after. So being able to filter by company type, demographic, decision maker, really valuable market intelligence that we then often pick up and, you know, sort of use to approach people through other means. But before we talk about sort of, you know, the methodology for reaching out to those people, I think it's important that we talk about another social platform that a lot of our viewers might be more familiar with in terms of etiquette or not. And that is, ladies and gentlemen, what is it? Let's make this interactive.
It's Tinder.
It's Tinder. Oh my God, you're psychic. I know. How did you know that, John?
It's magic. Read your mind.
It is in fact Tinder. So the reason why I say Tinder is, and you know, last time I inferred this subtly, but this time I'm just going to say it. John's wife was once on Tinder, and to be clear, this is before she met John, you know, sort of, I hope. And, you know, one of her experiences was she met this guy, he seemed relatively nice, but the whole interaction felt like almost a little bit staged and formulaic. And then at the end of the evening, he gave her a mixed CD of his favorite tracks. The Tinder conversation turned into a date. Thank you for backtracking. Yeah, that's really important for the piece. Yeah, this wasn't on Tinder. Very hard to give somebody a CD on the Tinder app.
Right.
Long story short, by chance, she then met a friend who, because Cape Town's a small place, strangely enough, had gone on a date with the same guy. And when they started comparing notes, we realized, well, not we, but they realized that essentially this guy was working through a script. And needless to say, that was the end of any future interactions. So I think the main point here is the fact that, it was disingenuous. It felt impersonal. It was a play by numbers. And unfortunately, when we use similar tactics for our marketing, it elicits a distrust. So simply spamming people with generic messages and firing off scripted emails is the very worst form of marketing, particularly if your intention is to build relationships. So
if I can interrupt you, tip my hat to that guy. He's playing a strategy. He is playing the numbers. It's just that he doesn't vary up his strategy. So as an example, if he had three different strategies for three different personality types, it's mixtape, flowers, something else. So that I think if his problem was he got lazy.
And this is obviously, carry
on. I think if it wasn't for the comparing notes thing, he would have probably gotten away with it a little bit more. So kudos. Don't hate the player, hate the game.
Yeah. Remember also, he only needed to be right once.
Yes. So. No. And I've got a sneaky suspicion he's got a hit rate of 1 out of 10.
But what's weird though is that I absolutely agree. It actually is a useful strategy. But I think in terms of the allegory we're making between business prospecting and Tinder, is that if that's what he is like in trying to meet someone, he's obviously not looking for the love of his life. He's not looking for,
it's not the quality of the relationship.
Exactly. So if you want that hit rate and those easy, short relationships where eventually the person's like, wow, you don't actually give a shit, then it's a way to go.
You know that we're not actually talking about Tinder in this podcast, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Yeah.
I like the strategy though. Like to talk about strategies, and I think that your way of doing it is a strategy. If our Tinder guy followed the five M's, he'd be great.
I'll talk about the five M's in a moment. This is the business equivalent of receiving an email from a Nigerian prince. You do realize that. Yeah. So,
well, what's weird is that I'm kind of guilty of this as well, because I went onto LinkedIn and I got in contact with. I was looking for work in the UK, and I got in contact with people I knew who were living in there. And one of the guys I used to work with in Japan is now a marketing director for a company. I can't remember their name right now, but I sent him a message, and it was a unique message, more or less. But I didn't fully do my research into what his company did. So when he came back, fortunately, he doesn't actually have control the conversation, the choices about, hiring outside help or freelancers or anything like that. So he said he couldn't really help me there, but out of interest, what do I know about the chemical industry, especially in kind of makeup applications and stuff. And I don't know anything about it because I didn't research his company. I didn't go deep enough into it. And if he'd been like, yeah, we got some work. It's awesome that you got in touch. We want to talk about nitrates. I'd be like, oh shit. Okay. I actually can't do that work. So I've done it myself,
Makes sense. I guess it's that trade-off between, efficiency and authenticity at the end of the day. Mm. But for contractors and people that are looking to build longer-term relationships, they do well to kind of follow the same types of, approaches that build relationships in person. And that is, genuine communication, taking time to understand the person that they're talking to, and also targeting their message specifically for not only the decision maker that they're speaking to, but the type of industry they operate in. So, mass marketing campaigns can be effective. I think the main thing is to realize that most of business growth for contractors and in B2B comes through referrals and network. And that's because there's already that social credibility there, which means that, you know, sort of they can tap into that. And credibility and trust is everything. So, you know, if you look at the fact that 80% of business comes from referrals and so on, how do you kind of leverage that systematically to be able to kind of, you know, sort of almost grow your business in the way that it's going to experience the fastest growth, but also the easiest by tapping into network? Any ideas? What do you guys think?
Yeah, I would say, and you're so right, you know, so much of, you know, the opportunities that might come your way, especially if you're a freelancer, especially if you're a hired gun, do come from your networks and the personal connections that you have, which is also, for me, why it's important to be sort of nurturing those sorts of relationships on a consistent sort of basis. And often I think that's what a lot of, you know, kind of freelancers and consultants or whoever else, creatives, might make the mistake of doing. They kind of only go out and search for work or go and put, you know, put the signals out there when they need it, rather than, you know, using it as a kind of a you know, something that you really do need to be nurturing and doing as a practice. You need to keep kind of keep that up. Where, and you might do it in the sort of direction of producing content, or maybe it's a newsletter. It doesn't really matter what it is, but, you know, I think people kind of see through when you know, the overall approach, when you're sort of just coming to them, you know, when your wallet's empty or when you need work. But rather, you know, whatever you do, especially if you're looking to, you know, work those referral networks, you've got to be doing it more, you know, on a consistent basis, especially when maybe you don't need the work. And that's obviously the trick, right? That's the difficult part. But yeah.
I mean, I guess it's not even only about mutual connections and the people that you know. It's also specific to companies. So, you know, for example, we were working with one small division of quite a large international company, and the work had gone well. So we specifically used LinkedIn to identify other decision makers in other divisions within that company, not only sort of locally, but also internationally. And, you know, as a result, because there's already that trust, you know, we've now brought on 4 other international divisions of that company. Which has increased our revenue by like 25%. So it's looking about who's similar. And if, you know, it's not a big company, then, you know, what other organizations Absolutely. Within that sector are similarly aligned, you know, to be able to do that. Is this a good place to talk about the 5 M's? What do you guys think?
I just want to quickly add to your Tinder and your relationships allegory or kind of simile on the fact that using LinkedIn as a way to see if there are alignments and values and interests and things that you have commonalities in. The same way Tinder tries to figure out interests and you kind of swipe through is to do the research on people that you admire or you respect or that you feel like will be able to make a real contribution. And to John's point, that it wasn't a genuine effort, because it was like a just fishing, really, more than actual delving into a problem. Because, you know, like, once you understand a problem, you can try and figure out the solution way faster.
Yeah.
And in that, there should be alignments and interests.
In my case, I ended up, you know, the messages that I sent on that initial kind of message burst ended up sounding a lot like, hey, you know, haven't seen you in years. How's it going? I'm looking for work. You know, it's like this transition.
Exactly my point.
So sudden.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly my point. Yeah, which is why it doesn't work. You know. Yeah.
But then the other flip side of that is that you can spend your entire life building a relationship, or, you know, prospecting in places where you might not have the expertise or the interest to actually do well in. So it's a case, I guess, of like going, who do I want to work with? What kind of work do I want to do? What kind of work can I deliver good work?
Well. Four. I agree. And these are the decisions and these are the questions you need to make when you decide to become a freelancer. You know, you have to be able to have the resources or the energy or whatever it is to be able to answer that for yourself. Otherwise, you know, that's a reason why you need to be employed. So you don't have to be. Yeah.
For years, we did strategy work for big clients to go like, okay, cool. You start with your values and your mission and your vision and all those things. And we don't do it for ourselves. Well, the agencies rarely do it for themselves. And if they do it, they don't implement it because we tend to be a little bit of prostitutes. But once as a freelancer, you can see people gravitate towards the type of work that they want to do because they're not happy. And also I went through years of working on certain things, and I'm going to have a bit of a whinge here. It's like you end up working on things that you don't really like. And it's a waste of time and effort and passion. And and these are the LinkedIn could be a great filter for that. And it's important for your own well-being. And I think as a freelancer, you should put how can I put this? Your own well-being in front of doing stuff. Because if you're doing crappy work, you're not going to be happy.
Yeah.
I think that's such a good point. Learning to say no. We often think that, if we're struggling to get something off the ground or we're just starting out with our contracting career, that we should take whatever comes along. And, it can be from a point of almost desperation. But that sets the tone for how you move forward and what comes next and what other types of people you're potentially going to be referred to. So, having the capacity and the strength to say no and living by those values is almost sort of critical. And then, I think another thing which I found worked really, really well, not only for myself in terms of being able to move between sort of different industries, because I guess I'm quite fortunate to have had a rather eclectic career. So, I've worked as a copywriter, I've worked in a consulting firm for a technology company, and people tend to think that it's not possible to break out of a mold into something new. And the provocative thing to do is start off by working for free. I know that sounds crazy, but if you can add value to somebody and you can show what your worth is, as long as they understand it's not an ongoing thing, it's a great way of building relationships. A lot of our business initially came from, taking the punt, paying money to book out a venue and inviting people to come and learn in an educational session where literally there was no sales pitch, nothing thinly veiled, nothing sort of driving them towards a sign up at the end. It was purely done with the intention of adding value to them. And we got so much work out of that because they could infer the value just through the content.
Yeah.
So, it's also a good way of kind of getting into industries or sectors that you may not necessarily have worked in before. Anyway, yeah.
Good point, Ed.
Is it time for the M&Ms?
Let's do the M&Ms.
Okay. So, we were talking last time about the fact that it's sometimes difficult to formalize an approach if you want to look at growing your business or even just your consulting gigs. And this is just a handy little acronym of 5 M's of ways to structure your thinking when you go about this. So the first one is market, then message, then methodology, then management and measurement. So starting off with market, the smaller you can go and the more targeted you can become in terms of the people that you approach, the more successful you will be, because essentially what it does is it allows you to tailor your message specifically to them, which ties into that thing around authenticity that we were talking about earlier. So really going quite small and personalized is far more effective than simply spamming 10,000 people. The other thing is that you're not wasting your time by having to field dozens of inquiries that end up not being relevant. So, if time is a commodity, go smaller. The other one is message. Keep it short, differentiate yourself, try and make sure that any message that you send to somebody, whether it's over email or LinkedIn or whatever the case may be, even Instagram, is below 150 words. Remember, it's a leader to get them interested. It's not to communicate the whole message. And the other thing is that message should be focused on the why, not the what. What I mean by that is, why do you do what you do? What problem do you solve? Not what you do. Not I'm a copywriter and I write sort of long form copy for financial services. The other thing is to allow them the option to dig deeper with that message. So sending them to a landing page, a website, some industry relevant case studies. That allows them to dig themselves without having to read a long, sort of boring email.
In the very specific case of I'm a copywriter, if the bad format of it is I'm a copywriter, I've got this many years experience, I've worked here, 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 and here, would you like to work together? What is the kind of a why-based approach that's in contrast to that?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I guess it would be something more along the lines of, I help companies refine their messages and proposition in order to be able to communicate it succinctly and engage their audiences. Mm. And very often, we've found that, companies sometimes don't differentiate themselves significantly to actually get that audience buy-in and engage them. So, I'm an engagement specialist, and this is the way that I've helped companies solve that problem previously.
Mm.
So it's more, I know that's not necessarily the best example, but hopefully kind of it communicates the concept.
No, I guess what you can also do is look at the industry or the company that you're talking to and say, for example, if you're talking to a car company, one of their core problems is that most car companies look and talk and sound the same. So if you then lead with, if you have a strength in differentiating a tone of voice compared to other companies, or I can help you, I like to work on, I like to make boring things interesting, for example. If it's a case of a company mm-hmm. that has a lot of technical information required and they work in a technical sector.
Then that's subjective point of view. I want to work on your boring shit to make it more exciting.
Yeah. I'd use the word complex rather than boring. Yeah. Come to think of it. Yeah. I like to make boring things interesting. I think you're my perfect client.
Yeah.
I guess, sort of the other aspect is that when you're creating that message, it kind of almost needs to be like laser focused on one particular pain point or challenge or something along those lines. And the real sort of, I guess, challenge for the person writing that message is that if they're an expert, they can sometimes assume that the client has the same knowledge that they have. For example, I'm busy going through a process of raising funds for a new venture at the moment. And having done 18 months of research on this idea, the first time I pitched sort of the presentation as a dry run to a good friend, he was like, what are you talking about? I don't understand this. It's way too much detail. It's way too academic. You need to look at it from the perspective of the investor. And it's exactly the same with marketing copy, I guess, is make it simple and make it about them, not you.
Yeah.
I'm conscious of the fact that we're running out of time, so let's quickly whip through the other M's. Methodology is, what platform do you use to engage your audience? Is it an event? Is it email? Is it Facebook? Is it Instagram? And the more channels you select, particularly if you're a small team or just a lone individual, the less likely you are to be able to execute effectively against any of them. So pick your channels carefully, and the best way to do that is to run tests. So that's where the measurement comes in, making sure that you're doing litmus tests and then documenting the results. Another thing here is, without sounding like, sort of an academic economist, try and make sure that those sample sizes are at least statistically relevant. If you're doing 5 messages on each platform and you get a response from one, that doesn't mean that that's the one you should be focusing your efforts on.
Yeah.
And then finally, sort of the management component, how do you systemize? Set aside time, have a methodology, make sure that there are process steps, not only in generating your leads, but how you deal with customers once they come through. If you don't have a clearly defined process that you're taking them through, it's very easy for the call to end and for it to go nowhere. You have to control the conversation. Have in mind what the next step is. Is it to run a workshop with them after the introductory call if it goes well? Is it to set up a session to undertake analysis? But you control that and have a clear idea of what the entire sales process is for that person. Because if it's open-ended, they go, cool, we'll get back to you. And they might genuinely mean that, and you never hear from them again because they're busy.
Yeah.
And I imagine, if you can get a date booked in, that's a big win.
Yeah.
Cool. Sorry, John, what were you saying?
No, I imagine that you don't mean that, control the conversation, you don't mean that necessarily in a Machiavellian way, but simply in a way that in a way that like the world gets out of the way for the person who knows where they're going. When you give someone
exactly
at the end of a meeting, like, I think what we should do is you know, we should put together a proposal and talk to this other client and see what, you know, then if people are willing to be led, if they're in that space, you know, like it's, yeah. When it's a young relationship, if someone makes a suggestion, it's unless that person, I think the majority of people will be happy to listen to a suggestion rather than have someone say, oh, I don't know, what do you think we should do?
This is so true. And I just want to underscore once again that last point that Ed made, and now that you've echoed again, John, because I get so many of these sort of, I'm assuming they're pre-written kind of mails on LinkedIn, even sometimes on email to my business email, just sort of saying, you know, here's what I do. And, you know, and sometimes the portfolio is great. You know, actually, most of the time it is great, whether they're a designer or copywriter or, a motion graphics editor, or whatever it is. But that sort of sense of next step, if I am interested, what do I do now that you've given me this information? All right, you've given me your CV, you know, but where does the conversation go? Are you expecting me to kind of go, great, well, actually, we've got a 500,000 Rand job that we needed done yesterday, and I'm so glad that you gave me a call today. It doesn't work like that. The sense of you being able to provide a process or a sort of a sense of what that next step looks like and where I'm now going to be led along your journey, if you give me a sense of what that is so important, because then that, you know, not only gives you some clarity into how you think and what the flavor of the services that you're providing, but also you're directing things. You're actually aiming to solve something rather than the other way around. So that is just super, super important. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, think about your favorite series. What keeps you coming back? They drip feed you information at the right time. Yeah. Not Desperate Housewives. Okay. So now I'm showing my age. I guess the thing is, like, you don't want to give them all of the information in that first call. You want to be able to provide enough information where they still need to satisfy something at the end of the call. And a really effective way of doing that is just sort of dropping a bomb in at the end of the conversation. Like basically like, oh, by the way, you know, we undertook a 2.5 hour analysis of your brand. And we came up with some really interesting feedback. Love to share that with you. Let me know. Do you possibly have some time next week and we'll talk you through it?
Sure.
So, you know, just little things like that where, you know, they're waiting to find out something more that keeps them sort of coming back again. Because the more points of contact you have with them, the more likely it is to actually lead to work because you can build the relationship.
Sure.
Cool.
And I think if you're a specific kind of creative freelancer, like a copywriter, for example, it could be, you know, saying, I've read your entire website top to bottom, and I've got to say your about section sounds a little bit disconnected to the rest of your copy. Or you can say, I'm a graphic designer and I've had a look through your social media pages and they look great. I do have some ideas as to how they could work even better. Maybe you want to chat about it.
That's great. Yeah.
You just got to make sure you carry on. Sorry, Alex.
No. I was going to say it shows some due diligence that you've actually, you know, it's not enough to just say, I've looked at your website, but if you've gone far enough to actually have some feedback or, you know, a suggestion, then that's, you know, you're setting a good impression. So absolutely.
Yeah. And I think it's also just about making sure that message isn't like a negative one, because if there's no rapport built up already, you know, kind of be like a stranger walking up to you going, hey, Alex, let me give you some feedback about your hair.
Yeah.
You know, like,
why did you pick that out of the blue? Just wondering.
That would need to be a 45 minute session.
Because nobody else on the call has hair.
Okay, fair enough.
It was redactionist. Yeah. So framing it positively, perhaps, like, here's some things that can make it even better, or whatever the case may be.
Sure.
Speak for yourself on the hair thing. I've got lots of hair, just not on my head.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no.
Image wipe.
Anyway, we're grateful this is a podcast. So after after management comes measurement.
So measurement is effectively measuring not only what converts, but also what progresses along the funnel. So the key metrics from a sales perspective are lead, qualified lead, which is basically they match your high level criteria for a client, sales qualified lead, i.e. they're interested and they're showing the signs of interest, to opportunity where you're moving to the proposal stage to close. And it's helpful to measure each one of those stages because it allows you to see where you're falling down in the sales process.
Right.
Everything's going to proposal. That's great. But if you can't close it, then that's where you need to focus your efforts.
Yeah. But now a freelancer might only have 5 contacts in a month period or something like that. So it's quite it's a relatively small data set. And you said to be careful about, you know, extrapolating, like this is the way to do it when you get one positive response in a certain channel. So how can you protect yourself against that kind of thing? Because businesses obviously do a far greater volume of prospecting for leads. So their data will be much more quantitative than qualitative.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of that can also be measured by, you know, digital metrics. Mm. Like if you're doing, for example, a campaign that's driving people to your website, what does Google Analytics tell you about your page views, the length of the view? Mm. You know, there's also information and things like that, or opens on emails or click-throughs. So those things kind of denote interest. There's also softer metrics, more so than just hard metrics, that can help you kind of inform that decision.
Yeah, because in the freelance client relationship side of things, it's a little bit more like, as you say, like a Tinder relationship. Is like, okay, cool. So I got an initial response. We set up an initial meeting, and then there was no follow up. So you have to be, without being an anxiety ridden mess, you have to kind of go like, now what did I do wrong between the presentation and the follow up that I lost that lead? Like, what happened there? Was it circumstantial? Did they find someone else? You know, did the circumstances change, or did I not give them enough help for the next step? Like, I guess it's only over time and through experience that you can kind of start to see the patterns, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And also persistence. So, you know, typically it takes, from our experience, often 3 follow-ups to get a response. Mm. And that's even while a relationship, like where you've had an initial conversation with the person. So, you know, learning to persist is really, really important. And also, if they don't want to go ahead, just asking them for their feedback. What totally. Was it that made you decide not to go ahead?
Yeah.
Is a big factor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think
carry on, Alex.
No, just a very final, I suppose running out of time, but a final sort of thought is, and also just being mindful of, you know, a lot of the audiences that I'd be listening to this would probably be more sort of, you know, creative freelancers and so on, where maybe some of the things that we've been talking about, you know, certainly make sense, but they maybe don't have, you know, the experience or maybe the will even to kind of, you know, go out and, you know, sort of create a structured sort of, you know, marketing and sales process for themselves in order to do this. But, you know, I think that there are definitely some things here that can help them, you know, begin on that. But often I think that with creatives, there's a real sort of barrier or, you know, or some sort of mental block, or maybe just a distrust or dislike of selling themselves, and sometimes maybe even getting to the point where they think that they don't need to, you know, that the work speaks for themselves, and maybe mm-hmm. in a lot of the time, if you're lucky, you know, if your portfolio is great, you've got some good connections, then that could be true. But at the same time, when you're looking to, you know, put food on the table, and when economic times are hard, you know, I think that's where there might need to be a bit of a mindset change or a sort of a shift in thinking, where these sorts of things aren't what other people do, but rather what you need to be considering in order to you know, to get your own personal brand out there, to be able to win work on your own, because this is what it takes. You do need a process. You do need to hone in on a message that speaks, you know, to a client in their shoes rather than, here's my portfolio. So it's, yeah. A couple of these things I think are really, really sort of critical. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Persistence at the end of the day, I suppose. Yeah.
So after, I think, measurement, was there one more, or have we gotten to the end?
We've got money. Them, so it's
money.
It's markets.
Money.
That's what's at the end.
The 6th M is
the
money.
6 M's. Yes.
So go through them all one more time for us.
Okay, so one more time, market and distilling that is really important, along with the message. And then we have methodology, what channels are you going to use? And then finally, measurement to make sure which channels are working, and management. How do you formalize your approach so you set aside time to do this either every day or every week? Because at the end of the day, you know, sort of one of the things that defines success as a freelancer, as a consultant, And probably one of the most important things is persistence and not growing disheartened.
Yeah, sure.
It's tough to get set up.
Absolutely.
And you got to just keep going. Yeah.
I think everyone's about to freak out because we're less than a minute away from the end of this call. Alex, do you need to run?
I do. Yeah.
Okay. Can Ed, okay. Can you jump on a follow-up call? And I promised to hit record this time. And I just got a couple of follow-up questions.
Love you all. Sure.
Dude, thank you so much for joining us, Alex, again, Alex. I really appreciate
it. Guys.
Let's do it again soon.
Yeah. Thank you.
I will cut you so no woman could love you.
Okay. Okay, so Alex has just put down, and we just want to kind of, I guess, wrap up a little bit. But I do feel like there's still quite a bit to chat about. Number one, I've got one question for you and one kind of ask of you. The question being, if I'm a freelancer and I don't have the experience necessarily that I can claim to be in a niche, you know, like let's say I haven't worked for a few years on a certain category of work, and I don't really have something where I can say I'm an expert in this field. Or if I've worked in an agency on a lot of crap clients that I actually don't like any of them, or it's, you know, an insurance brands and that kind of thing, and I don't actually have any interest in working that in my freelance career, do I start improving my skills in a category that I am interested in, like make my own content, like a vlog or a podcast or whatever it might be about, let's say surfing, if that's the kind of client you're looking for? How do you overcome the lack of experience you might need to claim thought leadership and expertise?
Great question. So, I mean, essentially you're asking, how do you pivot?
Yeah.
And the best way that I can, you know, answer that is from a perspective of, you know, sort of, I guess the only ways that I've managed to pivot, you know, over time. So the one thing I would say is, if you don't have a particular niche, I would start asking myself some questions. What am I interested in? What am I likely to do well in, even if I don't have experience in that particular area? So, you know, for example, a year ago, I decided that, you know, I wanted to try and start up a medical cannabis company in the UK, mm-hmm. To supply pharmaceutical companies. Other than having used medical cannabis to treat myself when, you know, I was sick, I had no experience of the space whatsoever. But judging where I am now, I would say probably several things helped kind of get to a point where, you know, I've now raised some capital. One is a passion to go and learn and find out more, and acknowledging mm-hmm. the fact that, you know, I didn't have that knowledge. So lots of online reading, lots of research. The next one is people. People are your best enabler. Going to find people that have worked in that space and have experience of it, because you might even realize once you speak to them, it's not something that you want to do. Mm. So going to find people that have done it before and asking them how they did it, because they might even help enable you get into it through their network or connections, because they see your potential.
Sure.
And then the other one is, you know, sort of choosing something. You know, indecision is the enemy of progress. So, you know, picking a particular sector that you want to go after. And I would say, you know, dream big and have a backup plan if it doesn't work out. So, you know, don't limit yourself ultimately. And then, you know, do the hard work of doing the research and find the people. Those are the most important things.
Yeah. I mean, and that also kind of brings up the whole kind of like follow your interest, follow your curiosity is something that I believe in. But at the same time, 90% of the work out there might be for insurance companies, like low interest categories that actually do have a lot of work coming out of them, but it's not necessarily your passion. So maybe it's a case of finding something that's that you might be good at to pay the bills while you work on developing the niche you're talking about. Do you think that is the right way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that sometimes, you know, you have to sacrifice. Sometimes you have to work in a particular sector that, you know, isn't necessarily first prize to allow yourself the opportunity to grow what you love. Mm. And if it's a case of having to get into, let's just say, something like insurance, even if it's not necessarily something that you love, the same philosophy holds true. Mm. You'll find out what you can. Start writing pieces, even if it's for free or at a very, very low cost base, to develop that portfolio and to start understanding how the space works. Sure. There's no substitute for doing, you know, it's an iterative process. The whole idea of, I don't have any experience in the space, I, you know, I'll never be able to break into it, is a bit of a cop-out and a self-limiting belief, because the only way you get your experience is by starting.
Sure. And there's enough resources out there that you can become an expert with enough, you know, with enough dedication and, as you say, persistence, you can learn anything.
Yeah, absolutely. That's whether you want to learn it, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The second thing was when we talked about a methodology for using LinkedIn to as a tool, as a research tool for finding the people that you want to talk to, you gave me a very specific kind of set of steps to follow in order to do that. Would you, can you share that with us?
Yeah, absolutely. So what I would do is I would start off by signing up for a 30-day free Sales Navigator account, which is a bolt-on to LinkedIn. And once you go into that, it's got some pretty cool sort of Boolean strings you can create in the English language. In other words, filters and search terms. Go and pick your company sizes that you want to target. Go pick the particular decision makers you want to speak to. Put in keywords that will then, you know, look for people that have those words in their profiles. For example, you know, if it's UX or something along those lines, whatever the case may be. Once you have that list, you know, there's a couple of things you can do. You can either reach out to them directly on Sales Navigator, or you can go and take their profile and, you know, add something to Chrome called Rocket Reach that will then surface their email address, which obviously you just need to bear in mind things like GDPR and privacy here. I mean, you can operate under the banner of legitimate interest, particularly if you're not spamming them. But if you, for instance, pop in a profile to Rocket Reach, it spits out their email, you can go and drop them an email. But the main thing is knowing who that list of people is in the first instance.
Sure.
To be able to target them.
And would you say, for example, if you're targeting a company that has a very active YouTube account, or let's say a social media account, getting to them through their DMs might be a little bit less creepy than magically having their email address. Unless, of course, their email address is available on their profile or wherever it might be. And then you can say, hey, I got your email address from your LinkedIn account.
Yeah, indeed. And then there is one other very, very scary option that's kind of fallen out of favor. And that is actually picking up the telephone, which is something that terrifies people. But it's all about the way that you approach that call. And it's probably the equivalent of, you know, sort of asking a millennial to throw themselves into a swimming pool filled with alligators.
Right.
Because people hate picking up the phone.
Corporate alligators.
Corporate alligators, because most people's experience is of, you know, bad cold callers. But if you're phoning somebody because there's a genuine way that you can add value to them, or there's something that you want to undertake pro bono to initiate the relationship, it's a much easier conversation because you're actually offering to lend them a hand rather than simply trying to pitch them something.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I've been on that side of the conversation where a couple of people have called me while I was the creative director at Virgin Active. And one of them was a guy who had made a surf movie in Durban. And he was calling to say basically, well, you guys have a lot of gyms and they've all got TVs in them. Could we, as a kind of a proudly South African and it's a sport and all that kind of thing, could we put our movie on some of your screens, you know, or can you make it available to watch on your treadmills and all that kind of thing? And although, you know, that kind of call comes with a whole bunch of work, like, because it involves the IT department, and in most big corporations, when you require the IT department, it stops right there. Like, you're
done. It's dead.
Like, just
it's
give dead. Up. Yeah. So it wasn't possible at the time. And also the treadmills, although it's a good idea, the treadmills are, some of them are USB powered, some of them are networked, and it's all a big chaotic mess. Even though it was not going to go anywhere, I always end up being impressed by anyone who will actually phone and say, hey, you know, like, can we chat about this? Even if it's immediately a no, I'm always impressed by the chutzpah of someone doing that.
Yeah, indeed. And also it's a considered approach, I guess. I mean, if it's something that doesn't require the other person to do a lot of work, it's more likely to succeed.
Yeah. That's a key thing is don't create work for other people if you want them to help you.
It's also how I approach it. I mean, at the end of the day, so, you know, if I was to call you up and say, you know, hey, John, I have listened to several episodes of your podcast. I think it's super interesting. You know, we're holding a small event, you know, for 10 people. And we think that you'd be able to make a really valuable contribution to the day. We would love it if you could join us. Obviously, there's no pressure, but, you know, I just wanted to reach out personally. Mm-hmm. That's very different to please love me and buy my product.
Sure.
So it's all about the angle at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Cool.
Cool. Well, that's a nice, so there, your basic strategy there is you upgrade your LinkedIn to LinkedIn Sales Navigator, which you get a 30 day free trial. And then you set a little kind of a reminder in your calendar that two, three days before that trial, because, you know, they're going to upgrade you and charge you something like 9,000 Rand. So you need to have that reminder to cancel that little bastard, because
they're
going to
take a kidney.
All subscription companies work like this now, where if you forget, then we're charging you forever. So good luck with that.
Yes.
And
yes.
LinkedIn Premium is particularly painful.
No hipster cappuccinos for you for over a month if that debit goes off. So.
Yeah, totally. It's a hectic thing. So you want to use that time to research all the companies, all the people you want to talk to, you know, screenshot, write down names, get all the information you need, and then you delist yourself from Premium, and then you go ahead, as you say, with something like Rocket Reach, or you go to their channels and find contact information. And as you say, try and approach it in the most non-creepy, natural way, mutually beneficial way you can.
Absolutely. Yeah, you've summed it up perfectly.
Is there any particular, can you think of any particular do's and don'ts for a South African freelancer reaching out to a company in the UK, say? Any difference in culture or the way the work is done? Any particular channels that we're not aware of?
So I reckon if you can, you just start sending the exchange rate and go like, how much money?
Yeah, literally. Yeah. Hey, did you guys know that it's 20 rand to the pound right now? I'm afraid. Yeah,
it's way more, dude. It's, I think it's like 22, 23. Not about
yeah.
I would say that, you know, the concern when sort of engaging with anybody in another country, there might be a bit of cultural imperialism. So what is the quality of this person's work going to be like? How much do they understand about the UK market? So being mindful of those things and trying to incorporate them into your message, showing credible examples of the type of work that you do so they can see the quality of what you're producing, and not being too informal. So one of the differences I would say that I've kind of picked up as a generalization between, you know, sort of the differences between South Africa and the UK is that the UK tone is less conversational.
Mm-hmm.
It's less like, hey, Brew, how's it going? Let's meet up for a coffee. Not that I'm saying that everyone does that in South Africa. The other one is that South Africa is quite a friendly, amicable place to reach out to people. You know, my response rates when I was marketing in South Africa were 300 to 400% higher than the UK.
Wow.
And that sounds fantastic, but I also realized that the opportunities were far, far less likely to close. Because often people are just being polite, or they're finding out more, they're tire kickers. Typically, if somebody responds in the UK, there's more likely to be genuine interest. So don't get disheartened if you get, you know, sort of far fewer responses. Typically, the ones that come through will be of a higher quality.
Right. And now is the core, if we're talking about freelancers who kind of work in the design, creative, writing, all that kind of stuff, is the core of that's obviously in London. But if you are searching by geography as well, you know, are there some hidden pockets of work that we might be worth looking into?
Big time. So, you know, a few places that really are on the up in terms of technology, creativity, and so on are places like Bristol. Bristol is starting to boom, both in terms of like a tech industry, and there are a lot of creatives there. Manchester, Liverpool, Birmingham, all of those places are outstripping London in terms of growth. I mean, obviously, they're not as big, so they're not as far along as, you know, their growth path. And then even places like Brighton. So don't simply target London. It might have a lot more companies to go after. But the other thing that you have to realize is that the competition is going to be far more intense.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. And what I wanted to ask as well, and now it's completely lost my head, gone out of my head now. Oh, yes. Okay. So Lucas briefly mentioned the exchange rate. Now, obviously, a big, in our minds, the perception is that the advantage for a UK company hiring a South African freelancer is that we work for cheap, but our quality is good. How hard is that? Is that something we should push when we are communicating with these companies? I mean, should we talk about the fact that, you know, hey, my rates are going to be much lower than anyone you hire in the UK right now, especially with the COVID and all that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's important to mention price, but at the same time, there is a perception that, you know, sort of, and I can't say this because it's a South African audience, quid quip is dead quip. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to hammer on too much about price, because if you go in at a ridiculous rate or even just a South African rate, people may not take you seriously. Yeah. So, you know, classic case, a mate of mine is a graphic designer, website designer. And basically he was saying that he couldn't get work from the UK. And he realized that when he was quoting them, his prices were too low, so people were distrustful.
Right.
Strangely enough, when he increased his prices by 50%, there was more sort of interest. So it's bizarre. There is that perception of value too. I mean, obviously, if you're going to go with UK rates, then you have to understand that that puts you in the same ballpark as everyone in the UK. But sure. You don't want to sort of like, you know, harp on the fact that you're the cheapest option.
No,
you want to talk more about value for money rather than cost.
Absolutely. Yeah. And would you say there's a rule of thumb, something like whatever you can figure out the UK rate is minus 20%, or you want it to be like a sweetener, but you don't want it to be the point. Like if they're just hiring you for because you're cheap, then it's not a good position to be in.
Yeah. I mean, I would say a few things if we're talking about getting paid. One is, you know, 25, 30, 40% below the UK rate, that might be palatable. If you start going less than that, it might enlist suspicion. Mm-hmm. The other one is you want to tie your payments to key milestones. So in other words, you don't want to do a massive amount of work because you have no idea who you're dealing with potentially and then not get paid. So make sure that you start small and you bill relatively early on for initial work to ensure that you are actually getting money. The other one is the easier you can make it for them to pay you, the better. So if they have to go through some sort of horrific, long-winded Forex process, they're probably less likely to work with you. If you could have a UK account or, you know, sort of leverage somebody who does, or, you know, have a simple, effective way of them paying you, that's also going to help.
Yeah, there were a few posts recently on the resource group about getting paid from overseas, and obviously PayPal being one option, but I think their rates are a little bit high. I can't remember the name of right now of the other website that was recommended, but I will research it after this and I'll put it in the show notes. So the outcome of a pretty big forum conversation was that that this website that I can't currently remember was a good service for receiving payment online. I'll figure that one out.
Cool,
Ed, thank you very much for just explaining that whole side of it, that more direct version of finding resources or finding clients. Really appreciate your time.
It's an absolute pleasure. It's been really great chatting with you guys, and thanks for the opportunity to share some information.
Awesome. Cool. Well, we will pass on your wisdom to a few other South Africans, and hopefully they can, you'll be doing some good by helping them find some work overseas.
Awesome. And thanks, Lucas. It was great having you on board. Thanks for helping us to denigrate John. I'm glad that I didn't have to be alone in that. It's been fun.
That I can unequivocally say is a pleasure.
If he got paid for it, he'd still do it for free.
Yeah. Cool, guys. I lie awake at night thinking of things.
Cool. Well, thank you very much. Sure. That's going to be it for this episode on finding work from overseas. And we hope that you will join us again soon. I think May is coming up, which means that we are going to be talking about taxes. We have got a great expert to talk about how freelancers can get their taxes sorted. And especially in the current situation, I'm sure there are some intricacies we need to be aware of, like not having earned any money in the last 4 months. Now 2 months. But thanks very much, guys. We'll chat to you soon.
Awesome. Cheers.
Cheers. Take care. Have a good one.